Sure. Well, we're here with Peter Burns in room two. Well, we're not in room 239. We're in the International Center. But I wanted to ask you about your early years here at UBC, and specifically, did you take over anyone else's job? Did you replace anyone, or were you?
Okay, I came to UBC from the University of Auckland in 1968. And this was a period when all the law faculties in North America were expanding dramatically. And UBC was effectively hiring six new young professors at that time, of which I was one. So I didn't replace anybody, as I understand it. It was just part of the natural expansion because of the large numbers of students who wished to enter the first-year class, and the first-year class was expanding.
And who were the old guard on your arrival?
Oh, Dean Curtis was the dean of the faculty. Charles Bourne was the public international lawyer, constitutional lawyer. Bertie McLean was the property and trusts person. Eric Todd was property. Who else was here at that time? Oh, David Huberman was the corporate lawyer. Jahnke, J-A-H-N-K-E, was international law and commercial law. And a person whom I can't suggest you that you find out as much as you can about, Ray Herbert, was contracts and family law, and Jim McIntyre was labor law. Ray Herbert was a relatively unique guy. He was the teddy bear of the students. You know, he was one of these guys who the students had great rapport with, and he had a very premier wartime career in the Air Force before he came back to teach at UBC. And Ray was very prominent in the profession as well. He became the treasurer of the Law Society, which is the senior position of the Law Society of British Columbia. Who else was there? Good question. There was also, at that stage, Leon Getz, who was corporate contract and legal theory. That's about all I can remember. I'm getting on. I can't remember these guys.
And were there, but obviously there were some characters here. You mentioned Herbert, was a small department at the time, obviously.
It was quite small, yes. And everybody knew everybody else, and played bridge during lunch and breaks, that sort of thing. It was a very tightly knit group, yeah.
And your previous work in New Zealand, had you taught there as well?
Yeah, I taught at the University of Otago and at the University of Auckland. And I actually didn't intend to end up in Canada, but instead intended to go to Australia. But one of the visitors to Auckland at the time I was there was a fellow who did become a professor here, who was then at Alberta, called Andy Thompson. He was natural resources, oil and gas. And Andy said, hey, you know, forget Australia. The real action's in Canada. So why don't you come to Canada?
So did you simply send in a CV?
No.
Was it, how did the hiring process?
The hiring at that stage was extremely informal. What you should appreciate is that the common law schools at that time were relatively few, right throughout Australia, New Zealand, the UK, and Canada. There weren't very many. And everybody knew everybody else, or at least knew of them. And the usual route was, okay, you advertise, but the telephone was the primary methodology of ascertaining whether you're even interested in them or they in you. And in this case, I agreed with Andy that, yes, I might be interested in going to Canada. And what he did was he wrote to two deans and just described me to those deans. And I got two offers, one from each. So I immediately...
What was the other?
It was the University of Saskatchewan. So I immediately went to an atlas and looked at the mean annual temperature of the two cities, and I knew which one I should accept if I got an offer, which I did. I was also, at that time, you see, everything is much less formal. I was vetted by Mr. Justice Nemetz, who became Chief Justice Nemetz, who was then the Chancellor of the university, and he was doing a tour of a number of Australasian universities, and he came to Auckland, and I had dinner with him. So it was as simple and informal as that.
So where did you meet Nemetz?
I met Nemetz in a restaurant with my dean, who I might add had a Canadian doctorate. He graduated from Toronto as a doctor, and my wife, and there was one other person. I think one of the senior professors from my faculty also joined us for dinner.
It sounds intimate and
it's
civilized.
Just the way things worked in those days. They don't work that way now.
What was the name of your dean
at that time? Yeah. Jack Northey, Northey.
So you didn't have a forum. There wasn't a competition.
No.
Where you had to go and
being realistic about it, the Canadian schools were in no position to compete. They had large numbers of students who were going to be coming to all the schools in 1968, and there were not large numbers of potential applicants for teaching positions. So they were scrambling just to get bodies in front of the students at that point.
They used to,
which doesn't mean that the applicants were not well qualified. It just means that the sort of formal scrutinies that you were talking about were not taking place. What would happen normally is that George Curtis would, the December before hiring people, go down to what's known as the, I was never involved in this, but it was a butcher's block. It was the annual meeting of the American law schools, and lots of young candidates from the United States would be there, and George would interview them. And there are a few on faculty still who got their positions as a result of that interview by George down there. Steve Wexler was appointed on that basis, yeah. I think he's the only one left that came up through that process. But in those days we had networks. Every Canadian school had networks into the Oxford, Cambridge colleges and networks into Harvard, Columbia and Yale, and they worked those networks very strenuously.
In my field, history, I've heard it said that all you needed in the early 60s was a PhD in the sign of a pulse to get.
Well, I can't say that any of my colleagues were just pulsated. They were all pretty good, actually. I'm thinking of the young Americans that were hired. Mm-hmm. None of them, apart from Steve, are here today. But the young Americans that came up actually were very good, extremely good.
Were they coming for professional or ideological reasons? Or?
Mixed.
We can ask them. But
Yeah, Bill Black's another one.
Bill Black.
Yeah, but mixed. They'd have mixed motives. Some were really pissed off about the Vietnamese War, and they were not ideological, I suppose you would say. They were not going to participate in it. Others, I think, just wanted a different experience. Yeah, you can talk to them about it. They'll tell you what it was.
So most of them, of the new ones, came from the U.S., did they, at that time?
I'm just thinking about it. The year I was appointed, there was me, there was another Canadian called Peter Barton, although he didn't come that year, he came the following year. Barry Slutsky was a Canadian. But all the rest, I think, were Americans. And then about 2 years later, we had a flock of Englishmen. Largely, I think, because a couple of our people were on sabbatical in England. And through that networking situation I told you about, they interviewed a bunch of people. And we had some excellent young English graduates who didn't stay with us very long because they wanted to get back. But the couple of years they were with us, they were first rate.
Who, do you remember the names of those?
Chris Carr. He became very big in the Liberal Democratic Party in England when he got back. He died of a heart attack about 5 years ago, or maybe even earlier, so he is quite young. But he was quite brilliant, superb lecturer. And intellectually quite brilliant. Now, the other young fellow was Richard Fields. Yeah, or Richard Field. Richard Fields, yeah.
And how does it work? Because I'm not, law is not my specialty, but you called UBC a common law school. So you could.
As opposed to a civil law school.
Ah.
And most of the schools in Quebec, for example, are civil law.
So Americans and Australians and Brits could all, sort of interchangeable. Their expertise was
the sources of law are just the same, apart from statutory stuff, which is unique to the area. Today, for example, the Charter of Rights would be pretty unique to Canada, although the principles embedded in the Charter are contained in a whole raft of common law that the other schools teach and apply and so on.
So you would learn, with a new position in a different country, you would have to learn the specific statutory.
You work like a dog for the first couple of months, making sure that you have the local statutes well understood. And also, you do have to read the case law because Canadian judges don't always apply the common law the same way that judges, say, in England would apply it. There are differences.
And how much actual referencing to, say, to England or New Zealand was done?
All the time. Yeah. If you're researching in practitioner has to do the same thing. If you're researching a particular topic, you get your Canadian law there, but you also get your English Australasian law as well, because you're acting for a client whose interests may not be in your view, supported by the way the Canadian law has been left or is going, and it may well be that one of the other common law jurisdictions has dealt with it, dealt with the issue that you feel ought to be dealt with.
So there's an advantage in a broad legal education.
Yeah, sure. But Canadians do this all the time. I mean, a Canadian would automatically do that, no matter what common law school they came from. They wouldn't have to go and take a PhD at Oxford or DPhil at Oxford to equip themselves that way.
Were the colleagues here, your new colleagues, were they helpful in this transition?
Oh, yes. They were just excellent. Oh, there was one other person I might add, and that was Jerome Atrens, A-T-R-E-N-S.
And he was from the U.S., was he?
No. Oh, no. Jerome was a Canadian through and through, albeit he has a BCL from Oxford. He did his graduate work at Oxford, but he's from Saskatchewan. And
is he still around?
He's retired, but he lives in Vancouver. Yeah, they were very helpful. They were helpful both just socially, but also in terms of not making too many goofs when you get into a classroom, making sure that if you were talking about a topic and so on, that they would put you in the right direction about where they perceive the important features of it are and how the local courts tend to deal with it. No, I must say I thought it was a very supportive group when I arrived. The young Americans tended to be a bit stroppier, using an Australasian term. And they probably didn't seek as much assistance as I did when I arrived.
Did they understand was it a question of not understanding the parliamentary system or the British model? Or,
well, if I can put it this way, I think they understood there was a difference between the parliamentary system and the congressional system. But they tended to take a unified view that their system was better than the parliamentary system. but they're open-minded about this. They're willing to talk about it. But I don't think we ever persuaded them otherwise.
What did they say? You can all, some Canadian ambassador to Washington said, you can always tell an American, but you can't tell them very much.
Well, I won't go that far.
No, we'll scratch that one from them.
Yeah. But I think they felt that their system of governance was a pretty good one, and they particularly liked the idea of elected judges. Most of them had clerked to some of the senior judges in the United States.
So in 1968, the law school was only 23 years old. Mm. There must have been people around who, well, obviously, Curtis, who were part of the original...
Well, the only ones part of the original coterie were, as far as I could tell, Curtis, Bourne, and Eric Todd. And Eric Todd and Bourne came after Curtis. But if you're looking at sort of the transitioning groups, those three are identifiable. Then you had, in the early 60s, Bertie McLean, Huberman, although Huberman would probably be a little later than Bertie. Bertie McLean, Leon Getz would have been a little later. Herbert. Bertie McLean and Herbert. Herbert would have predated Bertie McLean. And after that, it's just the riffraff that came, like me.
And where was the law school at that time?
The law school is exactly where we sit, except that it was a very small wood and rough cast building. with a library attached to it. And over where the, not quite as far as the parkade, but sort of where they've just pulled down a couple of huts, and there's a sort of blank space over here. We had two big brown huts, and we used to lecture in those as well. We had offices and lecture.
And the students then, are there any that you could recommend that we should talk to, and were there any notable students at the time?
Well, the notable ones I wouldn't suggest you talk to. you must appreciate 1968 was the high watermark of the student radical period. And that year, when I arrived, our guys tended to be pretty moderate and not very innovative. So they just occupied the faculty club. When I say our guys, there were students right across the campus as part of it, but tended to be law students who were leading the charge. And I think it was just a big hoot for them. But we had, you know, radicalized students playing out roles. And you know, they're bringing their dogs into the classroom, and they're attacking the institutions, and doing all the loud things that students in those days were doing. And that lasted, I think, for about 5 years, until the early 70s.
So it was rather a derivative, sort of off-the-shelf radicalism?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was not serious. In my view, it was not serious. It gave these guys a bit of a charge. But I guess the key guy at that period was Kerry Lind. And he's still around. He's practicing down in Granville Island. At least he was 5 years ago when I last saw him. And the other person who was not like Kerry was, quote, the firebrand, but was equally part of the radical movement, was Mike Harcourt. But Mike's was a much more tempered and thoughtful type of radicalism. Then you had all sorts of, you know, loonies, and they're not worth talking to. You know, every large group has people who are just a little off center and tend not to be very rational about what they're dealing with.
We heard about the guy with the crow on his shoulder.
The crow? Never heard of him.
No. I think Tom Shorehouse mentioned.
Yeah, someone who would bring his pet crow to class, I gather.
Did he? He wasn't in my classes. But, you know, you had real tensions between the left and the right. Within the student body. Students can be pretty difficult, vicious. At this point, it was a matter of if you like, anti-establishment conformity to be left-wing, very left-wing. And I can still remember one young guy in a first-year class who consistently took a right-wing position and would be dumped on by a couple of the other students. And he eventually dropped out. Oh, yeah. But he was a strange fellow. I have to say that. He had very strange views about firearms and the right to bear arms. But, you know, you had that, but for the most part, it was pretty congenial, even when they were posturing it was pretty congenial.
And the students obviously were mostly from BC or from Lower Mainland?
Yes. Yeah. Mainly from British Columbia. It was a very different student group in terms of makeup in those days. There'd be very few Asians. There'd be no Indians or Aboriginal people. Or if they were, there would be just a couple. And that changed in the middle 70s. The Asians started appearing in numbers in the middle 70s, and today I would think half the faculty would be Asian. And with the development of Indian law program, as it was then called, in the late 70s, we started getting our first groups of Aboriginal students.
So there was a growing kind of inclusivity and...
Yeah. Yeah. Like everything else, though, it takes time. It's not something that you can, by a sudden radical convulsive movement, do it. And today I wouldn't like to even guess at how many Aboriginal students there are each year. But I would, if I had to guess, I would say 20 plus. And we still have only, 180 in our first year class?
It's about that.
Yeah. See, we had a couple of years of 250 students. It just exploded. But it's settled back down to 180, and I think that's as a result of the faculty deciding that's the optimum number.
Can you describe your area of legal expertise?
It changes over time.
Yeah.
And you do tend to get stereotyped, I've discovered. When I came here, I taught criminal law and procedure, torts and international law, public international law. And I basically stayed with those courses all the way through to around 1979. And then the dean asked me to drop one of the courses because both criminal law and torts were first year courses. And so I dropped criminal law. But in that period, prior to that, I was writing in the area of criminal law and going to conferences and so on. And I can't persuade people I'm not still a criminal lawyer. So I keep getting drawn into criminal law meetings or criminal law analyses. Whereas today I'm really torts. Yes, I've kept that. And international human rights, international criminal law, as sort of the developing area that I've worked in the past 20 years.
And are those areas, are you the only, are you the only faculty member?
Oh, no.
No.
This, today, I was originally the only one. And I tried to persuade colleagues that this is where they really ought to be putting resources into. And it didn't work very well for about 10 years. But now we have, I would think, 3 international human rights people and 3 international criminal lawyers. And they really are very important areas, both domestically, but also internationally in terms of stature. All the major schools are putting resources into these areas.
And I jotted down that you were dean from 1982 to 91. And so I wanted to ask a couple of questions about that. And what were the responsibilities of of the dean at the time.
When I became dean, there were a couple of, well, the responsibilities of the dean, very simply, are to manage the faculty effectively and act as the representative of the faculty in the university and to the bar. Okay? What I had to set about doing in pursuance of that was to become very active in both those areas, because for reasons that I don't think are pertinent, we didn't have much muscle in the faculty, in the university. Very little political clout in the university. And we had lost a great deal of the visibility that we once might have had in the profession and among the judiciary. So I spent a great deal of my first 3 or 4 years ensuring that I got onto the key committees of the university. I made sure I got onto the budget committee, for example, which is a Senate committee, and also the tributes committee, which grants honorary degrees. That's really the only political muscle that a university has.
The degree granting.
The degree granting to people they think are either useful or worth it, or both, hopefully. So I did a lot of that stuff during that period. I left a lot of the liaison work with, for example, the Canadian Association of Law Deans to my associate dean, wanting to make sure that I didn't spend time away from the campus too much, because all sorts of financial decisions can be taken in your absence that you're not happy with when you discover them. And they would not be taken if you were there to deal with them. So I also spent a lot of time working with the bar and the judiciary and making sure they understood what it was we were doing, and basically trying to make them feel proud about what's going on at the law school, so that they, when they're talking about bar school or other schools, they speak positively about us. And this sort of thing, it seems trivial, but that sort of thing is absolutely crucial. There was one period in the early 80s when the Attorney General's department was talking about closing one of the two law schools at that time, Victoria and UBC. How serious, and you know, they were speaking for the government basically, not the Attorney General's ministry. But if they were serious about it, they would do it through the Attorney General's ministry, because that's where the lawyers were. That sort of thing makes the hair in the back of your neck rise, because you do get, it's a small province, and you get political decisions with enormous ramifications.
Was
being
that
made for the oddest reasons. This was during the time of the recession. Remember the early, the 1980s early recession?
83, I think, was the recession.
Yeah, and the government was looking for all sorts of ways to save money. And lawyers were not regarded as very productive. Engineers were, but lawyers were not. I don't think anything's changed there. And, you know, this was just one of the rumors that filtered out of Victoria. So it was much easier to deal with by ensuring that the people in Victoria knew that the judiciary and the senior bar would be outraged if UBC was targeted. Now, I'm not sure how serious that was.
Still, it was a rumor you wanted to nip.
Exactly. But that's the sort of thing that you always have to be concerned about if you're a dean. One of the other things you have to do is make sure that the president's office is well aware of the political support that the faculty, not you, the dean, but the faculty has amongst the bar and the judges. Because that's the sort of thing that affects the incumbent in the president's office. They'll take hard decisions as long as they know that there's going to be a soft response.
So there was obviously lots of room for you as the dean, in a personal sense. But I'm surprised there wasn't a mechanism in place. So you found lots of latitude to fill the role.
Oh yes. And different deans would deal with it differently. But you've also got to appreciate that British Columbia in 1982?
Well, it was 80...
Whatever it was.
82 to 91.
Yeah, 82 is not British Columbia as it is today. It was a very different type of physiology in the university, a social, political situation. You had, for example, a few very powerful, key, overarching figures in the university system. You had Shrum. Is it a name you know?
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Yep.
You had Jack Klein.
Gordon Shrum, Klein, yep.
And you had Nemetz. And probably during the period that I was dean, the most important person was Nemetz. He was a university person, and as Chief Justice, he was also a very cultured person. He believed in education and higher education, and he and his wife had set up and were perpetuating the Vancouver Institute, for example. He was, if he didn't think we were doing anything that was proper, if he didn't think we were worth supporting, we would have been dead in the water. So he was someone that I really had to get on board very quickly, because he had the ear of the premier, and it didn't matter whether it was a left-wing premier or a right-wing premier. It was his style. Current judges wouldn't work that way, but he would pick up the phone and he would talk to them. From my point of view, he was enormously helpful in a whole variety of ways, financially, politically. That was good. Then you had the other two members of the Troika.
Shrum and Klein.
Shrum I had nothing to do with, because he was really, he was a university man, but a powerful university man. He wasn't with the university any longer, but boy, he had clout in the university. And Klein was a guy you really had to be careful about. He had enormous political clout as well.
He had been had some connection to Hydro, hadn't he?
He had a lot of connection to Hydro. He had been the managing director of Macmillan Bledel. Mm. He'd been a judge before that. And then, did he chair Hydro?
Well,
I'm not sure about that. But anyway, he was a very significant guy. And he'd be a very important fellow to have feeling you're doing good work out there, but not a good fellow to think that you're not doing good work out there. He was a member of the that international group that the Trilateral Commission. He was the only Canadian that I was aware of being a member of the Trilateral Commission. Remember, this is a private group of Rockefellers, and I think the Bushes were part of it, but a whole small coterie of people from France, Germany, England. Only one Canadian, I think, who used to get together and think deep thoughts about where the economies of the world were going. It's a different world.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he was positive, and that was important.
So what would you do? Just pick up the phone to these guys?
Not to him. No, I never picked up the phone to him. I just made sure that he didn't think badly of us. And we gave him held a dean's dinner in his honor and gave him a small award for his contributions to the university, that sort of thing. So you sort of start from that. And, you know, I knew that he spoke to Nemetz all the time. And as long as Nemetz thought the work of the faculty was going well, then you could probably rely on Klein to assist if you needed. But I would never ask. I could ask Nemetz to do things, but I could never ask Klein. And I never had contact with Schramm. But they were the three guys in the province that had enormous political clout during that period.
Did other deans at the university have to deal with them too, do you think?
Well, I'm sure they had to deal with Schramm. I'm sure the guys in forestry and in engineering, maybe even agricultural, the agricultural faculty, probably dealt through Schramm. But his being a scientist, he was way off our path. But he could also pick up the phone and talk to the president of the university if he wanted to. He was a very powerful guy. He was a personal force.
And what has changed now? Is it less personal and more committee? Done by committee, or
I think so.
Can you put a finger on
that? No, I can't.
Change?
We're a much more complex, larger set of institutions today, and it's really not the same sort of university as it then was, in my view. It's bureaucratic. We have enormous layers of administrators. In a way that we didn't when I was the dean. For example, as the dean, I think I had, I had a secretary. The associate dean was always an academic. I think there are now at least three associate deans.
And an academic, you mean a...
One of the academics.
One of the academics in the...
Yeah,
in the
became faculty. The associate dean. And then we had an office manager, a person in charge of admissions, we may have had one or two other people, but there were only five administrators in the place for the same number of students as you've got today. Now, if you have a look, I think there are just layer upon layer of administrators.
I did look, and I think there's about 45.
Administrators?
45 support and secretarial and office.
Won't be many secretarial, because they cut secretaries down a lot. Anyway, I haven't kept an eye on that, but I just seem to get that impression there's a heck of a lot. Now, they're doing different things. You know, you've got a much more sophisticated admissions process, and a much more sophisticated placement process. In the old days, it would be just a phone call
for
placement.
Placement of
graduates.
Of graduates, right. Yeah. And today you can't do certain things that you used to be able to. You know, you get a call from the senior partner of the major firms, and they'd say, can you tell me where this guy placed? You can't do that anymore. Yeah, even if he's the top person in the school. That's an invasion of privacy. So they have to find out some other way than just phoning and finding out.
So, for example, an interview?
Interview. Do students know where they place? Do they?
I know roughly where I am at, but in roughly. The bottom tier. But.
Yeah, roughly. Yeah. Yeah, so things have changed quite remarkably. And I think, for example, the dean today has a much bigger role in fundraising. That's one of the big changes. I thought we were doing well if we picked up enough money for a few bursaries, a few scholarships, and a couple of lecture series. But today, I think the dean has to be almost constantly stumping, looking for more money for different purposes.
Well, this building is, I suppose, an example of the
that's right.
of what you can.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good illustration. Yeah.
And had you been as associate dean before you were dean, or did
oh no.
You?
No.
But there was the position of associate dean already.
There was. But I sort of come from the old school whereby the dean should come from the academic ranks and go back to the academic ranks. It's amateurism at its finest.
How did they choose you?
Well, they do it. It's the same thing that they do. They have a search committee, mainly faculty members and a student. From each of the different ranks, and a couple from the university at large. I think there is also a member of the profession. The Law Society appoints someone as well. And that's been the process, I think, now, certainly for the last half dozen appointments. And it's for a term of years. It's a six-year term, although when I was reappointed, I did so on the condition that it would only be for a half term. I figured 9 years was about as much as I could take, and certainly wouldn't be as much as my colleagues could take of me. So I did it for 9 years.
And were you able to keep up some teaching and publishing?
Oh, I always taught. Yeah, I kept a half-teaching load whilst I was dean. And publishing, I did publish, but it certainly was not as continuous as it was and is now today. Yeah. But I must say that the university was very good when I was dean. I got a call from Ottawa asking me to put my name forward for a position on the newly created Committee Against Torture, and that was in 1987. And I didn't know a lot about torture. I published a book on criminal injuries compensation, which dealt with victims of torture, I guess, but not specifically. And I actually spoke to Nathan Nemitz before I agreed to let them do it, and also to the president's office, because it would mean spending some time away each year, because it met in, or still meets, in Geneva twice a year. Hmm. And so I did that. I was elected to the first committee, and I was on that committee for 15 years, 16 years. And I was the chair of that committee for the last half dozen of that.
And the university was supportive?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's, I thought that was pretty significant. I can remember the old days. I can conceive of some of the presidents saying, fag. get it. For no other reason than it would piss me off. But no, I had no difficulty with the president's office whatsoever. And I was able to organize my classes so that I was able to continue and complete my classes. And also, one block of the trip away was when there were no classes. So it was really only in the winter that it really gave me a logistical problem.
So, of course, torture has came into the into the public eye with the Gulf War and the Iraq. And was that before? Did you feel that were you involved then, or was that before? Had you left the this
body? Well, I've always been involved. It's like criminal law; you can never get away from it. I was called as an expert before the Araya Commission. What's that? 5 years ago, was it? And then I was also called before the Yakabuchi Commission as an expert relating to, I've forgotten their names now,
The soldiers who were...
No, these weren't soldiers. Oh, these were the Canadians. Who had made the mistake of either staying in Syria or going back to Syria and were picked up and tortured. At least in my view, they were tortured. And now they're suing the Canadian government because they say that the Canadian diplomats didn't do enough to protect them. Not the same as Iraq. In the Iraq case, it was more obvious that the Canadian government blew it because RCMP officers, CSIS officers, passed information on to the Americans that led to Iraq's arrest and being sent back, deportation to Syria. That wasn't the case with the three I'm referring to.
So you're still involved in this?
I'm still involved in it, yes. There's a CLE meeting down in... just south of San Diego in December, late November, and they want me to talk about torture, among other things. So I'm having to engross myself with it again.
So you can retire, but not retire and keep.
That's right. They keep doing, and the RCMP for the last several years have had me back to headquarters to talk about torture to officers they're placing throughout the world and how they can actually detect torture when it occurs. So I can't get away from that.
No. And as dean, you must have had some at least nominal theoretical power over the faculty. Did you actually? What did you? Did you choose course? Did you? Were you? Could you determine courses and hirings?
We had a committee system, and I come from a theory of academic life whereby everything comes from the ground up. Not from the top down. And I left most of the important decisions to the committees. I may not have liked them all, but the committees were responsible for curriculum, appointments. What else? There's not very much else that's really important because the dean...
Courses?
Oh, course allocation.
Yeah.
We did have... actually, it was my associate dean who was responsible for ensuring the courses were covered. And that involved, I guess, a little negotiation with faculty. I never got involved in that in all the years I was there. I don't recall having to intervene in that. But theoretically, yes. And you know, the dean has some inherent powers. For example, it's the dean that really passes a student from 1 year to the next year. I didn't realize that, but I learned it in the trenches where a faculty member, I'm just trying to remember the exact details of what the a faculty member had screwed up with evaluation of a student. And when we went back over the material, it became obvious that's what had happened. And the question is, okay, how do we remedy this? Well, by contacting the central administration, I discovered we remedy it very simply. I just passed the guy through to the next year. and that's what I did.
So you could overrule the faculty member?
Although well, it's not an overruling because it's a very narrow power, and that's the power to advance a student from 1 year to the next year, not to change the grade. But that's what we did.
So if there had been an argument over a percentage...
If there's an argument over a percentage, I wouldn't have touched it with a 40-foot pole. Mm-hmm. If an individual student is complaining that way, he's got all sorts of appeals within the university, and if at the end of the day he still doesn't like it, he can go to court. But I'm not going to touch an academic's grade. I mean, that's intrinsic in their autonomy.
Mm-hmm. Just need to quickly break.
Sure.